much work in progress with Marina Cortez. This is work which is aimed at addressing foundational problems in quantum mechanics, but I'm imposing a little bit. I think when you invited me to give the talk, I was going to talk about a paper in Foundations of Quantum Mechanics on the principle of precedence. And this involves only a few mentions to it. Okay. Great, thank you. This talk will involve only a few references to quantum foundations, but that's because it discusses the context in which I would like to discuss issues of quantum foundations from now on. And also thanks to several people for comments and suggestions along the course of this work. Okay, so I want to start by talking about cosmology and what it means to make a cosmological theory. And I hope it's not seen as a little bit of hype, but maybe it is. So I'd like to start by mentioning two books, one with Roberto Unger in process right now, which is under consideration by some university presses, and then a book just by me. And both of these books address the question of what do we need to do to make a real theory of cosmology. They argue in different ways, and let me preface this by saying that this talk has a lot of motivation in it and a lot of argument. And I'd be happy for discussion and comment, but comment of the form of, I disagree with your motivation, or why don't you consider my motivation, I'm going to rule out until the question session, because there is a picture that we want to present here. So I'm going to be making some statements about cosmological theories. And you may agree, you may disagree, but take them as an attempt to make a worldview, as an attempt to make a picture, to address the questions that in different areas of theoretical physics we're stuck with now. And I like the lights on, those of you who are looking at the lights. Is that somehow better to make me dark? Yeah, okay. Okay. So there is a standard methodology for physical theory that we understand since Newton. And in the standard methodology, the elements are a fixed space of states, or sometimes it's a phase space or a configuration space. And on this fixed space of states, there act fixed laws. You do physics by locating the initial conditions on the space of states, what state you're starting with, evolve forward in time with the law, which is specified in advance, and then predict what the state will be in the future. I like to call this way of doing physics the Newtonian paradigm. And the major argument in these books, which I'm not going to repeat unless I'm asked during the discussion section, is that this paradigm, this methodology for doing physics, is inappropriate for cosmology. And in different ways, you can argue that to just take the standard theories of physics we have, quantum mechanics, general relativity, et cetera, which are all formulated within this paradigm, and extend them outward to include the whole universe is to make a mistake and commit a fallacy, which we call the cosmological fallacy. Again, if I make that argument, I'm not going to get to any of the new material and the work in progress. But that viewpoint is the starting point for these ideas, that we need a new methodology, a new starting point to do cosmology. Cosmology as a whole. And let me separate it by, there's a lot of good stuff in cosmology which can all be talked about in terms of subsystems of the universe, but very big subsystems of the universe. I'm talking about the foundational issues that arise when one really attempts to talk about a theory of the entire universe. Okay. So I take it as given that we need a new starting point to make a theory of the entire universe, and this work in progress is motivated chiefly by that idea and by some observations that now I'll talk about that problem. Okay, it's good to start with principles, and we start with Leibniz, who I think was the first person to seriously consider what methodology had to be applied to have a theory of a whole universe, a theory of cosmology. And Leibniz enunciated a governing principle called the principle of sufficient reason, that every question of the form of why is the universe like X rather than like Y has to have a rational answer. There has to be an answer to that question. Leibniz used this, for example, famously to demolish Newton's notion of absolute space, because you could ask the question, why was the universe created here and not 6 feet to the right? And there's no conceivable answer to that question because none of the causal processes in physics are altered if you moved all the starting points 6 feet to the right. And therefore, he argued that the principle of sufficient reason could not be satisfied in the theory of absolute space, and there's a similar argument for absolute time. Okay, so we take this principle as the starting point. It's a high bar. It's a very high bar because there are a lot of questions that we would like to ask, that we would like to answer, that we don't know the answer to. And you might say, are you really sure that every question that you might want to ask of this form has an answer? And I think the right answer to that is we do science because we assume it's the case. And it may be proven not to be the case for the time being, but we can always hope in the future we will know more. Okay. Now, a consequence of the principle of sufficient reason is another principle called the identity of the indiscernible that will play a big role in what follows. This principle says there are no two objects or events in the universe with the same property. If there exist two things which have exactly the same properties, they're to be identified because objects get their identity and get their labels by the properties that they have. And this, in fact, means that symmetries can't be fundamental. This cuts very deeply into the practice of contemporary physics because it says that you can't have a fundamental theory which has a global symmetry in it. And indeed, general relativity, which is in some sense, and again, that's not the purpose of this talk, but in some sense, a realization of these ideas with cosmological boundary conditions appropriate for studying cosmology, has no global symmetries. In fact, that's a theorem demonstrated by Karol Kukoc, that there are no killing vector fields or conformal killing vector fields on this configuration space of general relativity with cosmological boundary conditions. Okay, here are some consequences which have been drawn out by various people, Mach and Einstein, for example. No unreciprocated actions. There should be nothing which acts to cause things to happen in the world which is not itself acted back on. And this includes background structures like a fixed geometry of space and time, like the structure of Hilbert space. And also it cuts deeply because laws of physics in the standard form that I described in the Newtonian paradigm act to cause things to happen but are not alterable or acted upon because the laws are believed to be unchanging. The next consequence is causal completeness. We should be able to explain and answer the demand for sufficient reason within the universe that we observe. It's unfair and not allowed to make reference to things outside the universe that we observe ourselves to be in. All causes must close, all chains of causation must close within the universe. Yes, Rob? I'm going to duck that. Thank you for that question. I'm just going to duck it. Okay.
Are you arguing for a spatially closed universe then?
And the cause, to the extent that the geometry of space makes sense fundamentally, yes, of course. Because otherwise there are boundary conditions, whether it's asymptotically flat or asymptotically ADS or whatever, and boundary conditions have to be imposed on the boundaries which correspond to things entering from very far away. Okay, now, there are four questions that we're going to focus on in this talk, two which have been discussed a lot and two which, to our knowledge, are fresh. The two which have been discussed a lot, which we certainly lack sufficient reason for, are what chooses the laws, why these laws, and what chooses the initial conditions of the universe. The two ones which in this context are not so discussed but are going to play a big role in what I have to say are why does the universe have a strong arrow of time, in fact several strong arrows of time, and what causes events to take place in the first place? And I'll be discussing each of those in turn. Okay, let me first talk about why these laws. And I always like to discuss this in the context of a quote by Charles Sanders Peirce. And basically what Peirce says, he restates the principle of sufficient reason with respect to laws. He says laws above all else need explanation. It's not sufficient explanation to just posit that such and such is the law of nature. You have to say why this is the law of nature. And he says the only possible way of accounting for or explaining a law of nature is to suppose them the results of evolution. And again, there's a long argument about that leads to that conclusion that I'd be happy to engage in after the talk is over. This is not a viewpoint alone that that Charles Peirce had alone. Roberto Unger, who's my collaborator on one of the books, has said much the same thing. This is from a book that he wrote in the 80s, and I hate it when people read quotes to me, so I'm not going to read the whole quote. But let me emphasize the kind of radical, basically we're saying earlier or later universes might have had different laws. To state the laws of nature is not to describe or explain all possible histories of all possible universes. And he goes so far as to say only a relative distinction exists between law-like explanation and narration of a one-time historical sequence. There's a lot to say about that, but let me turn to some of our colleagues, because the idea that laws of nature evolve is not a new idea, even if it is not often discussed. Dirac speculated about that. We should consider the laws of nature continually changing with the epoch instead of holding uniformly throughout space-time. And even Feynman, and there's a very Feynman-esque quote, and I wish I could do it the way that Feynman said, but basically he says, the only field that has not admitted any evolutionary question is physics. Here are the laws, we say, but why? How do they get that way? In time. So it might turn out, after all, there is a historical evolutionary question in physics. And of course, Johnny Wheeler speculated about this. Now, if laws evolve, then the often speculated idea that time, quote, emerges from the laws of physics, from the Wheeler-DeWitt equation or something like that, can't be the case. Because if laws are changing in time, then time is prior to law. So time must have a reality even more fundamental than the reality that we usually ascribe to laws. And I will just take that as a given and as a challenge to invent a new methodology of physics within which time is real. And what we mean by that is that all that is real in a present moment, which is one of a succession of moments. There's nothing timeless which is real. So in particular, there are no timeless laws which somehow act outside of time to cause things to happen in time. There is an objective, meaningful distinction between the past, the present, and the future. And your principles and laws of nature are allowed to refer to the past, the present, and the future. As because things which are true at a given present. And there is in particular no mathematical object which somehow sits outside of time and is the perfect mirror of reality. This dream that reality is mathematical and our goal as theoretical physics is to discover a mathematical object is, I think, a mirage. This picture raises several issues, and lots of issues, but here is just three of them, which may... this is what I mean by that. And Neil, before you, this is all motivation. If I gave all the chains of logical connection, I would never get to the new stuff. Okay. Why does time have a single universal direction? Why does time, quote, always go in the same direction? Why aren't there regions of the universe where sometimes it goes backwards to us? Why is there always a next moment? Is this somehow guaranteed in principle? And is the present moment thin or thick? Thick means that many events, many, quote, moments of time might be connected in with one, quote, present reality. Is the present thin? Is it just one thing at a time? Or is it have some thickness to it? Yes.
Do you distinguish between the present and the past as inferred from the present?
Yes. That will become a big deal soon. Okay. Now, just to mention that there are specific ideas about the evolution of laws of physics on a cosmological scale, and this work is motivated by one of them, which is what I was supposed to be giving a talk about, which is the principle of precedence. So let me motivate this the following way. We're used to the idea that if we study quantum systems, if we prepare and measure some quantum system that we have studied many times in the past, then the outcome will be the response to this measurement will be as if we took the ensemble of previous instances where we prepared and measured this system, and as if it were randomly chosen from that ensemble. And why is that? Well, we usually think that's because there's some timeless law of physics, some Schrodinger equation or unitary evolution, which acts on each of the instances as it has in the past, it will act in the future because it's timeless. Okay. But that's a really crazy idea, just to get you in the frame of mind that we're in. That's really nuts. What is this thing which is supposed to be a law of physics, which is doesn't have any evolution in time, doesn't have any physical properties, but acts at every moment telling things what to do? How do electrons and quarks know which equations to follow? This is a radical metaphysical idea in the guise of a scientific principle, the idea that there are timeless laws of nature. I just want to shake you up a little bit. And we're so used to it, we don't realize how weird it is. In fact, there's a less radical assumption that can explain the same fact that experiments in the future turn out to be the same as experiments in the past, which is already stated. I just have to cross out some words in the language that I gave. If we prepare and measure a quantum system we have studied many times in the past, the response will be randomly chosen from the ensemble of past instances of that preparation and measurement. That's actually the only law of nature we need to do quantum dynamics, I would claim. And that is a principle of physics that explicitly refers to the present and the past in a way that, quote, timeless laws do not. Now, the ensemble of past instances of a preparation and measurement is a real ensemble that physically consists of events that physically really took place. So referring to it is fine within the principles I talked about. It's things happening inside the universe, or things that happen inside the universe. However, it raises puzzles of its own. If for this to really make sense, we have to be able to, we have to be within a framework in which it makes sense to compare events that happen at different times and talk about which ones are similar and which ones are not similar. And the present and the past must be meaningful. So that's the motivation for what now follows, which is the new stuff, which is the work with Marina. Okay, so that was the motivation. Now let me talk about the framework we're developing. To address these issues that I've raised, we're going to work within a theory of events, a theory that has an ontology of events. The history of the universe is said to consist of a series of events. And what is time, the activity of time, what time does, is a process which creates new events out of present events. And this is prior to statements of what are the effective laws. So the notion of causation of an event bringing other events to exist, of a process which brings new events to exist out of old events, is more fundamental, we want to posit, than what law is acting. This process defines a relationship between new events and its parents, which have the property of a causal set that is a partial order with no closed loops. And Raphael has, and his colleagues have studied theories of cosmology and quantum gravity based on notions of causal sets. And what we're doing is a kind of impure elaboration of that, as you'll see. If I can say it, Raphael and his colleagues tend to be purists and demand that there be a description of nature in which only causality plays a role and the only properties fundamentally are causal properties. We will not be purists in that sense for reasons that I will explain. But causal sets are playing a big role in what we're talking about. Okay. Now, let me remind you of our two basic principles from Leibniz and draw out another set of implications of that, which has a long discussion in history and philosophy of science, which is relationalism. What you get when you talk about nature in a way which is consistent with the principle of sufficient reason, the identity of the indiscernible, is a relational picture in which things don't have, events or things don't have intrinsic properties. Their properties, their identity is defined by their relations to other things. And the particular kind of model we're talking about, the relations that an event has are its past, its causal past, the sequence of processes that caused it to exist are among its properties. Now, by the principle of the identity of the indiscernible, if events are specified by their relational properties, in particular their past, they must be unique. Hence, each event must have a unique causal past. And that's one way, and that demand is, which is going to play a role in what follows, is one way in which these differ from standard causal sets. Now, this is a funny thing to say, because if you think about it, it says there's a tension with what we usually think about as the tenets of reductionism. When we usually think we're doing science in a reductionist way, we think we're using the common sense advice to understand something composite by reducing it to the properties of its elements, of what it's made of its constituents. And we have a notion that things get simpler as we get smaller. Okay, but there's, and that's good advice and that works all over science, but there's a problem with it for fundamental physics, which is presumably there are some elementary particles, elementary events, elementary processes, which are not themselves made up of smaller events, processes, or events. And they have to have properties if we're going to do science. We're going to have to compound the properties of larger things out of these fundamental things. But where do these fundamental things get their properties? Because we can't break them down into smaller things. So reductionism is very, very important, but is limited, can't go all the way. The only way out in a relational picture is if the properties of the most elementary particles or events are defined by their relationship to their environments, are defined by their context, by their network of relationships to the world that they're part of. And this means that the smallest things, the most elementary processes, require a complex specification, because to distinguish them from each other, the history has to be sufficiently complex that they can all be individual. So an event is labeled by its past. Here's some simple causal set. There's another event labeled by its past. They're different, and if I did it right, every event in that picture has a distinct causal past, but you could easily find that I screwed up. Except the first two. Thank you. Raphael mentioned that yesterday. You always have to, you can't start with just one, because then you just get a chain. You have to start with some, you have to cheat to get started. Thank you for mentioning that. Okay. So, but lots of causal sets are ruled out because they have non-unique pairs of events. So this means what I said, that in a large old universe, there's a lot of complexity in the characterization of the most fundamental things. So what? So the way we talk about this is we say we have a world constituted of events, a history constituted of events, in which every event is distinct. Every event is unique from every other. So what kind of laws apply to things, every instance of which are unique? That's the challenge to discuss. Yes.
Why do you define the relational properties just in terms of the past as opposed to in terms of the future as well? So you can get around the problem of requiring atoms that are indistinguishable relative to their causal past by making them unique in terms of their causal futures.
So right, but very good. I don't know that that would help, but in any case, the assumption here is that the past, present, and the future are real, and we're doing this description of the world at some moment of the present. So if we're doing describing the world at a moment of the present, the future does not yet exist, and the properties of the future are not yet known. Okay. Two questions I said we would be addressing. One of them is, what determines which events occur? Now, you might think, since we know a lot about physics and we're always talking about events, Einstein talked about events and so forth, that there would be a framework in which you could predict which events occur. But when we thought about it, we realized that actually that doesn't exist. Classical field theory is deterministic, of course, but has no events. It just has things that smoothly change. Classical non-relativistic point particles interacting via potentials have no events. They just have trajectories that smoothly evolve. Now, quantum,
what's your definition of an event?
A discrete event.
A discrete event.
By events, sorry, I should have said, I mean that events which are discrete and countable. Because it seems much simpler if we don't have to deal with the real numbers to do fundamental physics.
In a continuous field theory, you have two fields that are occupying the same region of space-time. You can say every time those fields had a difference that was some particular number, real number, then
let me make the point, because there is a new point to be made here. Okay, and I think that what we're saying is correct, and let me make the point, because that will go to a new proposal. Okay, so let me just keep making it. If it's not clear, can I just make the point? If it's not clear in a minute, okay. When we do quantum field theory with Feynman diagrams, there are events in a Feynman diagram which are parts of specific histories. But there's no determination of which events occur. There's just quantum probabilities, probabilities computed according to quantum mechanics for which processes and which events may be occurring. And finally, classical particle dynamics. And this is, by the way, something that we started to see, those of us working on relative locality, started to see as we worked on relative locality. There is a classical, I'm looking for an eraser, dynamics, relativistic dynamics of events. Which are classical limits of Feynman diagrams. So two particles come in, they scatter from each other, and they go out. Or two particles come in, one decays into two particles, one of which scatters with the other particle that came in, and they go out, etc. And if you give the process, if you draw the diagram and say, I want to satisfy the laws of relativistic mechanics for these processes, if you say whether it's this one or this one, you can solve the equations and find out what the future, what the right values of the position and the momenta, the trajectories are. But you can't tell in advance. You can't tell the classical relativistic dynamics what's going to happen. You can start with the same initial conditions, and they might just go through each other. I think I drew this on the transparency. They might scatter. They might exchange. One might decay and exchange a degree of freedom with the others. And there's no there's no principle of determinism acting here, even though this is completely classical mechanics. Do you want to know the Lagrangian? The Lagrangian is a sum of free particle Lagrangians for the world lines, plus for a sum over the interactions. And for each interaction, there's a conservation law, which we can call Ka, which is applied at each interaction. And those are enforced by a Lagrange multiplier. And the free propagations has a form of P, x dot minus a Lagrange multiplier times p squared plus m squared. I'll actually be coming to those again, because that'll be a limit of the model that I'm going to discuss in a few minutes. Okay, so that's a model of relativistic dynamics with interactions. And we have been playing with those in the context of relative locality. But I just wrote it down for standard special relativistic dynamics. Okay. So the point is, and causal sets, which are the primary research program that has really studied the idea that the universe is a process with discrete events, doesn't have a deterministic version. It comes in quantum versions where you compute the decoherence function for histories, or it comes in classical stochastic versions, but it doesn't come in a deterministic version. So the claim that we'd like to make is that, in fact, there's no precedent in theoretical physics for a theory with discrete events that explains what causes particular events to take place. And if we're ambitious and we want to satisfy the principle of sufficient reason, we want to explain everything, including why this takes place rather than this takes place or this takes place, given the same initial conditions. Now, to do this would be tantamount, we tantamount to giving something like a hidden variable theory for quantum mechanics. So if this is going to get back to quantum physics, remember I said at the beginning that even though I'm not hardly mentioning quantum foundations, my goal is a framework to which to do quantum foundations. Then a explanation for which events occur, why these events occur in the history of the universe rather than other events, has to be non-local, because we know from Bell, et cetera, that hidden variable theories have to be non-local. Now, yes. Maybe, but I started out by saying we want to talk, there are some issues we want to address, and we want to work within a framework in which there are discrete events in the history of the universe is discrete events. And within such a framework, we went looking for what kind of explanation, what kind of laws would tell us which events took place and which events didn't take place, and we didn't find it. That's what I'm pointing out. There's no precedent. I can't go to Raphael and Fay and collaborators and say, give me a precedent for explaining which events occur and which events don't occur.
Are you saying the background
space
time is given?
No. Oh, in that, the background space time is given. You'll see in a, yeah. This is all, the blah, blah, blah part of the talk is almost over, thankfully. Okay, in fact, I'm going to skip through some blah, 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 and just tell you what the blah, blah, blah is about. Why are there strong arrows of time? I'm going to skip five transparencies that argue that we don't know the answer to that question. That the standard story about why there are arrows of time, both a thermodynamic arrow and an electromagnetic arrow, is to blame it all. That is why, in spite of the fact that the laws of physics are time symmetric, do we have such strongly time asymmetric universe, is to blame it on the initial conditions being very special, which we say is not, is just shoving it under the rug. It's not an explanation at all. So skipping through that discourse, which would make this a two-hour talk, since we're trying to reformulate laws on a cosmological scale, we're just going to take the viewpoint that the fundamental law we're looking for, which is going to be the law which says which events occur, is time irreversible. And that will, rather than the usual thing of time reversible laws, which coarse grain under certain conditions to time irreversible effective laws, thermodynamic laws, we're going to investigate the idea that the fundamental physics is time irreversible. It coarse grains at some scale to reversible laws, and then above that, some other scale, the irreversibility comes in again. Okay. Here's the last blah, 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 which is about the role of energy. And this is a kind of implied critique of a lot of discussions, both in fundamental space-time physics and fundamental quantum information kind of physics, quantum mechanics physics, which is there's a lot of people who discuss frameworks for fundamental physics in which energy and momentum play no role. Okay. And I think that this is insufficient, that energy is what makes physics different from sociology or computer science or any other application of mathematical description is this beautiful way in which energy and momentum play a role and get paired canonically with time and position. And we're going to posit that this goes all the way down, so that at the fundamental level, we need a theory with energy playing a role.
Does that imply also that space-time geometry must go all the way down?
No. Yes, part of the blah, blah, blah is we usually think that momentum and energy are defined by Noether's theorem, which says that their conservations are consequences of symmetries in space-time. But let's look to general relativity, where there are no symmetries generically, where matter is not conserved, is only covariantly conserved, the stress energy tensor of matter, but nonetheless there is a fundamental stress energy tensor of matter. So we're going to take the point of view that I'll do a little bit of that, blah, blah, blah. So we're going to take the point of view that energy is fundamental. And in a few slides, I'll have a model on the table. Yes. This is a discrete world, so you'll see in a minute. In fact, this is a summary of everything we've said so far. Let me skip it. Let me mention the three issues that we have to address. Is the present thin or thick? Is it objective? What about distance simultaneity? What decides which events are generated, and what's the role of the energy? And now I'd like to introduce a class of models. Okay, so the blah, blah, blah is over, and the rest of the talk is a class of models that we're in the process of studying. And then the talk will be over. Okay. So we're going to assume that the universe is produced in a sequence of steps. In each step, a new event is generated from present events. There's going to be a notion of the present in the causal set which differs from the past. And we do this in the following way. There's a number R, which is how many children an event can have. So an event cannot have an unlimited number of subsequent events that depend on it. In this case of this picture, that's 2. And the present consists of all events which have been created, but which have not yet been saturated, which don't yet have 2 children. They have 0 or 1 children. The past consists of the events which are saturated. Okay. And that gives us a description of the present, which is thick. And this seems necessary to make the model work. I apologize for that. There's a bug in Keynote. I could not straighten that out. Each link connecting, here's a piece of such a causal set. Here's the jth event, the kth event, which together created the ith event. And there's a link connecting the jth event to the ith event, which says that that process took place. And there are 2 momenta which label that process. The pji labels the momentum incoming to I, and qji labels the momentum going out of I. And each event, and these are live in an energy momentum space, which for the purposes of this talk is flat, but could have some non-flat geometrical structure. And each event then has a total energy momentum, which for the purposes of this talk is the sum of the energy momentum. Yes? Yes, sure. We haven't had to impose a law that the trees can't die. But the model we've most studied, which is a 1+1 dimensional model, we had to impose periodic boundary conditions to keep trees from dying. And that was sufficient to keep trees from ever dying. But these are not just trees, but there is... Actually, what am I saying? How can it die? There's a process which continually acts, which makes new ones. Oh, yeah. So there's a fixed number of parents as well as a fixed number of children. Okay. Sorry. That's in a slide coming in a little bit. Okay. So this class of model, yes?
So again, to the process before, if you just label something by the momenta, then you can have a graph like this and represent many different events in space time. Right? If this was a process of something.
Well, this is not, there's no space time yet. The space-time is coming in the way that you know from working on relative locality. That's a clue. Okay, so far, there is just this model is specified by giving the process which generates new events out of old events, which we call the event generator, and giving these laws which tell you how to propagate energy and momentum from old events to new events. And there are three laws we need to talk about: the conservation of each event, the sum of the incomings is the sum of the outgoings, the parallel transport on each edge, which introduces some parallel transport degree of freedom U, which we're not going to study, but it's sitting there to refer to the possibility that the space-time which emerges is not going to be flat. But in this talk, that's just going to be one. And the energy-momentum relations. And we're going to study the simple case that p squareds are all zero, so the particles are all massless. Okay, that's the model. There's an abstract causal set, which is generated by some rule, which I characterized as knowing about the pasts of the events. It creates new events out of old events by some process which knows about the causal pasts of the events. And momentum and energy are propagated from old events to new events by the conservation laws. Okay? And that's the complete dynamics. There's no space-time. The only time that's playing a role fundamentally is the sequence of generation of events and the causal structure that's generated. Okay, so now you can go home. That's the model. Now let's study it. To study it, we write an action. I never did get a pointer, but let me point up to that action in the red box there. And it's an action of the form which is familiar to those of us who work on relativity, which is the action consists of constraints, and the constraints are enforced by Lagrange multipliers. And for every kind of constraint, there's a kind of Lagrange multiplier. Let me point out the conservation laws live in momentum space and are one per event, so they get a Lagrange multiplier which lives dual to momentum space, one per event. That's the Zs. Then the parallel transport laws are associated with the edges. And associated with the edges are also the constraints that enforce masslessness of the momentum and energy. Okay, so that's a way to express the dynamics. Notice that there's not a px dot anywhere because there's no space-time and there's no trajectories in space-time. So that's the entire action. Okay, but let's, yeah? Yes. Where does that come from?
Yeah.
That's our choice.
That was part of your original principle. Your laws would evolve. So having an action principle doesn't seem to me something that's violating that principle.
Very good. Let's discuss that at the end. That's a fair point, but let's discuss that at the end. An event is a primitive, you see, the problem is it's a primitive of the theory. Everything else is to be described in terms of it. It's where something happens, which yes, but we're about to get space-time, so let me actually, so having blah, blah, blah for 40 minutes, let me now start to produce some results. Okay, because I blah, blah, blah to motivate the interest in a class of models, but now here we start to get some results, and they start by looking at the equations of motion, because if there's an action principle, you should vary all the degrees of freedom and not just the Lagrange multipliers, and if you vary the momenta, then this is the equation of motion that you get. There's the momenta associated with an edge. The parallel transports are one, so it's the same momenta coming out of the Z, the K, as going into the I, so I've identified those. And then you have the equation of motion tells you that the difference between the Zs associated with the two events is proportional to some Lagrange multipliers times the momentum on that edge. And let's think about what that means. That means the space-time emerges. Now there's one of those equations for every edge, that is for every pair of related events. It may not be possible to solve all those equations simultaneously with solving the conditions for the momenta. It's very easy to invent circumstances where they can't be solved. And then if they can't be solved, there's no solution of the model, of the action principle. When they can be solved, you can interpret the Zs, which started off life as Lagrange multipliers, as coordinates which embed the events of the causal set in a flat space-time. And there was no space-time to begin with, so how do I know that this space-time is flat? I consider the norm, and the norm, when I compute it, inherits the metric eta from the momentum space. So whatever geometry I gave to the momentum space implies a geometry for the space-time, and what you get is an emergence of the space-time with an embedding of the causal set in the space-time geometry. Yes?
Explain what is U here. Is that the definition
for U? U is one. U is, you would, if U were in there, this would not be the case.
Right now, in general, what is U?
U is, I'm leaving open the possibility that I was going to come back and refer to in the end, that U is an additional degree of freedom of the model. And when U is not equal to one, it should have some dynamics of its own, and you're not going to get embedding in a flat geometry. So U is, We haven't completely shown that you get embedding in a curved geometry when U is not one, et cetera. But U seems to be an obstacle to embedding in a flat geometry, and therefore maybe embedding in a, thank you, thank you. Momentum. Very good question. You asked the same question when I talked about relative locality, and that was also a context in which momentum was assumed to be prior to space-time position. Momentum, let me justify that by saying, I could say it on two things. At the level of this model, it's a primitive, but physically, I could make the case that measurements of momentum are primitive measurements. You'd have a calorimeter, something strikes your calorimeter. You are able to measure the amount of energy deposited in the calorimeter and the direction from which it came, and that gives it a momentum and an energy.
How do you measure the direction without reference to space?
It's no space.
No. I don't have to answer that question. There is space at some level, and I'm allowed, if I'm constructing the empirical counterpart to my theory, I'm allowed to use everything that the theory generates, not just what's fundamental, but what's also emergent. And that's a question that's come up before in relative locality. Okay.
You're saying that the space-time gets a metric from this structure, but I doubt that you get a proper metric or in the case of a non-trivial momentum geometry. You get some momentum.
Oh, absolutely. That's why in this talk we're just doing the case where the momentum space is flat. Yes, absolutely. I mean, this is kind of like if the geometry of momentum space were other than flat, this would be kind of like a pre-geometry for relative locality. And in the next couple of slides, you'll see that even more. Okay. Whoops, I always forget how to. Okay. Now, not just space-time emerges, but massless particle dynamics emerges. Okay, so consider now a long chain of events in the model, and consider that we can neglect half the momenta, that there's some momenta propagating, which are the solid red arrows, which is much larger than the momenta propagating on the dotted red arrows. So we can ignore the momenta on the dotted red arrows, and it's just a chain of events, one in and one out. Whenever this occurs, if there's a long such chain, does this work as a pointer? Yes. Then we can consider the case where the Lagrangian multipliers M are small since they're arbitrary, and solve the model by the usual way in which we would expand the ith plus one, the coordinate of the ith plus one particle event embedding as the ith plus what we'll call the time derivative of a continuous z. And then the action reduces in the limit where the number of events in the chain is very large. Oh, there we go. And the Lagrange multipliers are taken very small, and the delta t's are taken very small to the standard form of the action for a relativistic particle. So the free relativistic particle emerges naturally in the case where there's one momenta which is much larger, there's a sequence of momenta which are larger than the others that they interact with. If those chains are bounded by events where we have to consider the whole process and the whole conservation law, then we get left over. The action reduces to the sum of the action for chains, which is the relativistic particle action, plus the interactions, and these are of the form that I had on the blackboard here, the Lagrange multiplier times the conservation law. Okay, so standard relativistic point particle dynamics with interactions emerges in a natural way from the model. And this is assuming that the events have been specified. Okay, this is a slide that I'll just exhibit and I can come back to if anybody asks, but there's a twister formula. In 3 plus 1 dimensions, there's a twister formulation of the whole thing. Which gives a kind of pre-geometry for a twister space. But probably only Neil here and maybe a few other people know twister theory. But I'm happy to come back to that because we're kind of proud of that. Where is my zinger? Okay. Now comes the core, which is, how do you choose the event generator? What ideas go into the process that generates events? We know it has to depend on the relational properties of two events. We want it to be non-local, and it has to ask the question, if this is your causal set so far, what's the next set of events that's going to generate a new event? How do you choose which is the set next event that generates a new event? Because this is the question you have to answer if you're going to explain which events take place and which don't take place. We know it should be non-local. We know it should depend just on the causal past of the events. So here's the proposal. The proposal is to invent a measure, dij, of the difference between the past of two events, I and j. So if we consider two events, this one and this one, there's a measure of how different are the relational information in the two pasts. And this could be computed several different ways or defined several different ways. One way to define it is to consider the adjacency matrix of the graph, which represents the past of one, the graph that represents the past of the other one. Take the difference and take the norm of the difference, and that's a measure of how different the pasts are. And then the rule to define which events take place is to allow the two events which have the closest, the most similar past to each other to be the ones that generate a new event. And this is just a game. We're just playing with a model. But the intuition that goes behind that is that if you and I are standing close to each other at close to the same moment of time, we have similar pasts. So in the realization of the real world, the further you are, the further apart two events are in space-time, the more they have different causal pasts, distinguishable causal past, and therefore the less likely they are to interact or to be progenitors of a new event by a causal process. This is a game, sure.
Okay,
this is a game. This is a class of models. And let me jump and say, because I'll take the questions, but the whole goal of this is to motivate a class of models to study in the computer. And the 1+1 dimensional case, we are studying a bunch of these in the computer. Unfortunately, we don't have results from those. We thought we would, but we don't have results from those to present right now. But this is a kind of theory, a kind of game to play, to investigate the ideas that I've discussed in the talk. And I'm almost done, so let me just take one more.
So what happens if the distance is the smallest between two paths that are completely causally disconnected from each other?
Then they're no longer called, then they will.
But they're the most similar paths.
Then that's. If your game has generated causally disconnected regions, then they will no longer be causally disconnected. This is a game to play to investigate the consequences. Okay? This is certainly a kind of rule which is non-local and irreversible. So it's the kind of thing that we want to play with. And unfortunately, I wish I was in a situation where I could say, we studied such and such a realization of this and saw X, Y, and Z. Let me just finish the talk, and then maybe at this point, because I've gone an hour, let me finish, and then we can discuss. Okay, so computer simulations are in progress on 1+1 dimensional models. The dimension of the momentum space. And what we're interested are, and here are the questions that we.
When you say similar, is that counting also the momentum that you put on the test?
It could be, or it could. Both, we're studying both cases. Okay, so what do we want to examine with these class of models? We want to know, are there choices of these games, of these event generators, for which, first of all, there are the distribution, the simplest question you can ask is, does the distribution of events become uniform? Or if you start with some initial conditions, does the distribution of events stay non-uniform no matter how long you evolve into the past? Can you coarse grain the distribution of events and the distributions of energy, the densities of energy and momentum? Can you coarse grain them and find emergent rules or laws acting? For example, some form of hydrodynamics or relativistic hydrodynamics. Can we study the idea that maybe even if the fundamental laws are time irreversible, there is a level where there are emergent laws which are reversible? Could phenomenon emerge which are analogous to self-organized critical phenomenon? And let me come back to that if somebody wants to discuss. There is an analogy between this model with the events being generated one by one and self-organized critical models studied by Per Bach and other people, which suggest that that might be the case. But we don't have results yet that show that. Okay, and conclusions. So the conclusions are, we study the consequences of real time within an ontology of events. We focus on the question of what causes events, what explains events, and argue or study the consequences of the idea that what generates events, what the philosophers call causation, what we call the event generators, is more fundamental than anything else in the specification of the laws of nature. Events are distinguished by their causal paths and are assumed to be unique. Hence, each action of the event generator is unique. So the event generator is something like a rule to generate the future from the present, but it's not like a typical law of nature in that since everything it acts on is a pair of things which are unique, every version of its action, every time it acts, something unique is happening. I already mentioned about irreversibility. The event generator compares past and hence is non-local. By adding energy and momentum, we can have a causal set, something like a causal set, but an impure version of a causal set that naturally generates, when it has solutions, its own embedding in the space-time. And finally, both twisters and relative locality emerge in specific cases. And very much thank you for all the discussion and criticism, and let's have more discussion. Thank you. Rob?
I want to maybe criticize your definition of distance in your causal network model. But I don't think it can coincide with our intuitive notion of distance. And it connects with what Alyosha's question was. It seems to me you'll have to weigh the distance past more weakly than the nearby past to get it right. So imagine you have two organisms on Earth that have an evolutionary ancestor, and then 5 billion years of common causal past based on that common ancestor. And then two organisms on another planet that have another, deep billion years of common causal past. And then one alien gets off in a spaceship and meets one human somewhere in between in a very short period of time relative to those billions of years. I would still say that, they don't have a more similar causal past than any two organisms from that planet or any two organisms from our planet, just because of the heavy weight of those 5 billion years of common past. So you would then find out that, you're not reproducing our notion of a human and an alien being close to one another. So it seems to me a more reasonable definition of distance in a causal network would be something like, how many steps do you have to go to get to the greatest lower bound in the network? And if it's small, then they're close. And if it's very large, then they're far apart.
Thank you. I mean, this is a class of ideas under development, so I'll just take that. I think we can just take that as a suggestion. Did you want to respond? Yeah.
Yes, so we want to, the important idea is to generate events which are based on unique properties of each event. This is a model for comparing, selecting which events will act, which events will interact. We are, just as an example, we are comparing their paths. It's exactly, we are getting to the conclusion that you're saying, that you can't take the whole past into consideration because nature would have to make a lot of computations in the first place to generate the next event, and also because what you're saying is the events that are generated based on the whole past could not be close enough in a physical distance. But what we want to find is whether these properties of irreversibility and events evolving to become unique, whether these properties naturally evolve under these principles. And the law that generates the events is we're just picking one. We don't have, we're picking one to study a model, and then we'll try another one. The principle is that we want to observe, obtain an irreversible dynamics, and then the event generator, we will try different prescriptions.
Yeah.
I've got two questions. First, if you were to apply this to the study of cosmology, our universe, how would you do that? Say you had a model that worked that explained all sorts of known physics. How would you do that? How would you would need to specify initial conditions? What kind of initial conditions to compare it with cosmological data, for example? And the other question is, how does this reproduce? This is supposed to be a non-local model of hidden variables. How is this reproducing standard Copenhagen interpretation of quantum mechanics?
So those are both questions. And I hate it when speakers do this, but I'm going to do it. Those questions are far in advance of what we've been able to study so far. I can tell you some dreams. So let me discuss the second one first, okay? Because I do have a general viewpoint on quantum foundations, which is partly expressed in the principle of precedence and partly expressed in the real ensemble interpretation that I discussed a couple of years ago. Okay. And this is that quantum mechanics does refer to ensembles, but those ensembles should be real. That is, there should be no imaginary ensembles. This, again, this is part of not having things that are not part of the universe influencing things inside the universe. I used to like the ensemble interpretation, but then I realized that makes the choice of what happens in the universe dependent on something which is abstract and idealized and not in the universe, which is an ensemble of instances or an ensemble of systems which are not real. So I've been investigating in different ways the idea that quantum mechanics is a theory of real ensembles that really exist. Now, if that's to be the case, there has to be a new kind of interaction in nature amongst the elements of those ensembles. Because if the ensemble is, as in this case, the ensemble as in the case of the principle of presence, the ensemble of the same system being prepared and measured, how does the system know what are instances of, quote, the same system? Are they systems that, what if you have a little contamination of a magnetic field, and does that change it? Does that mean it's not your system? Is it formally realizable systems? If systems have the same formal description in terms of, say, a two-dimensional Hilbert space, does that count as being the same system or not? And to address these questions, and in the real ensemble interpretation or formulation, there are questions like that too. I said the ensemble is the ensemble of all quantum states of all systems which you would describe as being in the same quantum state around the universe at a given time or in the past. But what really counts for being in the same state? So both of these ideas require there to be some physical notion of similarities of systems in which systems are likely to interact with each other in a way that would be acausal for us if they're similar. So that sounds just nuts, right? And, well, it sounds, the point is that what it means.
One question. Does this mean that when the universe was young and inexperienced, it behaved like deterministically? Because it had not enough. The ensembles were small in some sense.
I don't know the answer to that. Let me finish addressing the first thing. So, required that there be in fundamental physics a notion of similarity of systems or similarity of events. And that's some of the motivation for building in this idea of similarity in the event generator, to study a kind of dynamics, a form of dynamics in which there can be, in which how similar the properties of two events or two subsystems are gives them, affects their ability to interact with each other. Now, about the how precedence gets set up, again, without a context to make sense of the whole thing, I found it wasn't really possible to address that question, but that's an obvious question. Marcus, if I can single him out, has some very interesting work about that as well, which I'll let him talk about if he wants to.
Yeah. Well, maybe some other time. Yeah.
Yeah, John?
How would I know experimentally that one of your models works or doesn't work? Maybe I should not use the word experiment.
No, that's very fair. There should be there should be anomalies of different kinds in the application of the standard laws. And let me mention some kinds that, not a particular model, but some things that if the philosophy behind these ideas is true, things to look for. Let me mention two things. One of them is look for new sources of time asymmetry. If time asymmetry, if the fundamental laws are really time asymmetric, then either in particle physics or cosmology, there should be residues of this fundamental time asymmetry. And that can be looked for and should be looked for even harder. If there's something like the principle of precedence is true in quantum mechanics, then if our friends over at IQC and similar laboratories could construct a quantum system that has no precedence and study its evolution, they should find the Schrodinger equation is not satisfied. Schrodinger equation based on the potentials, the interactions that would be, that you would expect to be there on the basis of the constituents, should not be satisfied when precedence has not yet been established. So the idea in general that the laws of physics fundamentally are both time irreversible and evolve and change in time should have signatures of all kinds. A little model like this is not meant as a realistic physical model. It's meant as a laboratory for exploring a set of ideas. Lucien?
So your penultimate point in the conclusions suggests an answer to a question that I think you've raised before, which I think you called the inverse problem. Mm-hmm. You take a typical graph of these causal sets, something else that's typically not going to correspond to a low dimensional, but embed naturally in a low dimensional space-time. It'd be nice to find a way to make it do so. So if you add these if you generate your causal set with these vectors that you call any momentum, then maybe you can constrain your causal set to embed in a low-dimensional space-time. But then surely your growth dynamics would have to speak to those vectors. I mean there'd have to be some communication between the sort of dimensionality of those vectors and the way in which the graph grows. Have you addressed that question?
Only the simplest aspect of it. The simplest aspect of it is that depending on the dimensionality, there should not be too many parents to an event, or it won't be possible to satisfy those equations. For each parent, J, K, L, and the P's on them, there's an equation of the form Z I A minus Z K A is that momentum times the Lagrange multiplier. And it basically says that the event here sits on the light cone of these events. In 1 plus 1 dimensions, if you have more than two parents, you can't satisfy that generically.
And that's not a sufficient condition for natural validity as you have a really large graph.
You only need to be. I don't think there's anything else. At least we haven't found anything else in the 1 plus 1 dimensional case. The second way, which we haven't, I think, unless Marina has done this yesterday or today, is put in the event generator to depend explicitly on the energy in the graph, but we have talked about doing that. Because to give energy a role, after all, energy, the more energy something has, the more frequently it should act. So as we begin to build and play with these models, we will be giving energy a role. Let me not say that. Okay, just a couple more questions, yes?
Yeah, a very basic question. What does it determine scale in your theory, scale of time, for example? You said that some notion of the speed of light or something that this is determined. And also, what are the determined scales for which this irreversible role became reversible, and another scale on which it became irreversible?
So there are no dimensional parameters in the model as given.
It should be something for
quantities. So at the present, there are no dimensional quantities, so there's no scale, period. And in fact, in the 1+1 dimensional model, what emerges is not a flat metric, I should have said this, but a conformal class of flat metrics, which leads to some interesting ideas that we've played with, that the effect of coarse-grained dynamics will be something like a classical version of a conformal field theory. In the real world, imagine that these are very baby ideas. Imagine that they grow up and become real ideas. Okay. Then what determines what is large is a good question. And in terms of where irreversibility turns into reversibility, some n is becoming large. N should be the number of events. But how large means large, we don't know. We don't know. It's a very good question. It's the right question to ask. I hope that these ideas survive long enough and grow up enough that we can address that question. Yeah?
Do you guarantee that you... you'll never wind up with two events with the same past with this law?
No, but if they come up, then you have a process by which they are identified and they merge. That's the key idea for evolution.
They now get identified.
If they do, we know that they. This will not happen because we are working in the continuum for labels of the events. So if you have continuum numbers available, you won't have two events that have the same past. But that idea is so important that we would, if two events emerge that have the same past, that is, they have the same relational properties, then they are the same event. They are identified. These two events are just one event from then on.
But go ahead.
The position seems to mean that all of your causal networks are just equivalent to the chain. Because the first node,
all the first nodes
are totally equivalent.
No.
And then all the second nodes can be described as things that have a parent that have no parents, and so they're all equivalent.
No. Raphael raised this yesterday. Said you have to make an exception for the start. Otherwise, what you're saying is right.
When you say make an exception, do you mean?
You have to have a set of events which have no past. There has to be more than one.
And they have to be distinguished, but not by virtue of relational properties.
Yes.
Of other things.
Yes. That's what the meaning of have an exception for the original ones.
But I think I get the same problem, because if I look at the tree that comes out of that atom that you've called one, well, all of its children have exactly the same past, namely the node one. So I identify them. And all of their children have exactly the same past, whose parent is one. So I identify them. So now all you've got is a bunch of atoms, each of which has chains coming out of them.
I don't think so. Let's start with five.
Yep.
Let's suppose that. So again, these are distinguished by virtue of a special gift. So this past is different. So if the following happens on the next step, this past is different from this past.
Right. So if you had no colliders, like any tree that branches out of a single atom doesn't collide, that reduces to
right, but the process always makes new. There's always more than one parent.
I see.
And let me also address the I think the following is true. I may not be thinking clearly because I'm on my feet. But if I have some event which has a causal past which is distinguished from all the others, and another event which has a causal past which is distinguished from all the others, and I make a new one whose causal past is the union of those two, then it has the property that it has these two subsets which are distinguished from all the others. And I think that means that it's distinguished from all the others, but I'm not sure. That's wrong. Okay, other questions? Yes?
So this is going to be inspired by what was asked before about the action. How is this model that you showed in any way using your ideas of time evolving us? Because all of this is actually timeless.
It's not yet.
Action which is timeless, initial conditions which are a few nodes which are timeless. And everything, like even your evolution law is like a set rule. If you have this, then this happens. And it doesn't really take into consideration the idea of time and evolving in time.
Mm-hmm.
So all of this is really timeless.
That's true. Yeah, that's true.
So how would you implement something that's timeless and that's evolving in time and has some rule of that evolves in time together with the evolution of
the well, the depends on how radical you want to get. So one way is that the event generator, which is the thing that's playing the role of the law, could itself change. The most interesting way that could happen, which we just speculated about, is that the event generator could be recursive. That is, the past of an event could code the rule by which it evolves.
But then if you have two causally disconnected regions, which then have to combine in some way.
There would be some rule to something like a genetic algorithm would have to happen.
But even the genetic algorithm has a rule that says the rule for this is
yes.
Something. And that is like a stated rule of the game.
So you're constructing a deterministic evolution in this. No matter what the rules are, the way you define it is deterministic, which again goes against your initial premise that theory, like the classical theory is.
No, sure. So maybe, I mean, I'm not uncomfortable with that. I hope this doesn't blow the whole interest for everybody else. The idea that there's no timeless law motivates an interest in a theory in which the present and the past and the future play a distinguished role. Okay. Then we discuss some other things that we would like that such a model to do, and we're playing with ideas, in my mind. Okay. This is not meant to be a proposal for the whole world. It's a game to illustrate some ideas. In particular, the questions that the ideas lead to are, once you apply the principle of the indistinguishability of the indiscernible, then all events have to have a unique past. Then you ask, how could there be a dynamics which acts on events that are specified each uniquely to produce a new event? Okay. Then we're playing a game. We introduce a model. We introduce a game to study that. Okay. Behind it is the hope that one will get some insight that will enable us to, you know, to make a deeper move. A deeper move might be, well, what do you mean by a law that applies to unique instances? If every instance of a law, application of a law is unique, then is having a fixed rule really the best way to address the question of causation, of what causes something to happen? And I don't know the answer to that. Am I making sense? Okay.
But even if your rule is a recursive, like your evolution law is recursive,
yeah.
then it still has the rule that, I mean, you can still set that rule that tells you how the dynamics happen. So this is not really it is in some sense a timeless.
This is a model. No. Let me emphasize. Okay, I don't believe that there is a mathematical model which is a mirror of nature. So I make models to discuss implications of ideas. We study models. We've discussed a set of ideas. Then we said, let's see if we can write down a model which illustrates some of these ideas and lets us investigate their implications. Okay. We're not trying. Marina may disagree, but I don't think we're trying to invent the theory of everything.
The main idea here is that we want to make the universe emerge from laws, fundamental laws that are irreversible, laws that have an arrow of time. And the arrow of time is what is causing all the processes to occur. So this events model is a way to find out if we can make these principles emerge. We have our classical reversible laws, and we want them to emerge from fundamental irreversible laws. And this is a way to study how those could, by which processes could those reversible laws appear.
But are those two ideas not in conflict with each other, where you say that you want to have irreversible laws and laws that laws that have to involve time and something. That laws that really are not laws but some kind of evolving. Mm-hmm. That's not the same.
I don't think so.
It's exactly the opposite. If you have a law, timeless laws are laws for which time does not play a fundamental role, for which you could imagine evolving time in one direction or the other. If you take time seriously, then the evolution is fundamentally only in one direction, and that's the one principle that you want to start with. It's different from having a law, an evolution which could be taken to process in both directions.
So I've been asked by Bill to take over the chairing, and I'm going to suggest that we take this conversation offline and just thank Lee again.
Thank you.